Today is Thursday, the 2nd of April, and this is Kathy with the commercial news for today. Starting with page one, on the first page, the headline reads, Hospital Planning for Possible Patient Surge. As the number of persons diagnosed with COVID-19 in Illinois continue to rise, and with two confirmed locally, OSF healthcare officials say they have continued to plan for a potential surge in patients. A second case was confirmed late Wednesday afternoon as a person in their 20s, but who is not connected with the first case. Dr. Vincent Kucich, K-U-C-I-C-H, Chief Medical Officer at OSF Healthcare Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville, said they are in daily contact with their ministry partners in planning for potential surge in patients, making sure the number of beds, protective equipment, ventilators, drugs, and other needs will be met. Specific plans are fluid, Kucich said, adding that plans will change as the hospital starts seeing any positive cases and to make sure it's taking care of other patients. He said the medical staff treats and isolates patients with a variety of infectious diseases on a regular basis. He said they can change part of the bed structure on different hospital floors to maintain isolation. The Danville Hospital has about 75 beds generally for patients. Kucich said the hospital has only about 40% of the normal patients right now because most patients without serious symptoms are taking and heeding Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker's order in staying home, and many are being treated at home as needed through telephone and video calling efforts. As part of the hospital's approach to the coronavirus, it had already placed a tent outside of the emergency department in Danville. The tent is the temporary entrance to the hospital where mission partners and patients are screened prior to entering the hospital. There's also the vestibule area to screen patients in case of bad weather, Kucich added. OSF healthcare officials say preparedness mode efforts were ramped up in coordination with the local emergency medical system in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Kucich said the tent and screening process appear to be adequate right now. However, they've talked with the National Guard for the possibility of a larger tent. Space constraints would be worked on as needed. Kucich also said they have a good supply of masks, ventilators, and other equipment. He said the OSF ministry has a tight inventory for the hospitals. We have access to greater needs in sister hospitals, he added. He said the Danville Hospital also is, for the moment, staffed quite well. He said no one is calling in sick, and they have a full complement of specialists, hospitalists, or physicians who treat hospital patients, and nurses. If more doctors are needed, other OSF hospital staff from other cities can be brought in. Kucich said Wednesday that they don't have any positive COVID-19 patients in the hospital, but no others are awaiting tests, and a surge could happen in the next couple of weeks. Vermilion County at this point has been quite low, he said. There is always the possibility to reach the max point at the hospital, but they are hoping not, he added. He said there have been offers from outside agencies to use outside sites close to the hospital as part of an overflow strategy for patients. He added that hospital staff have drills for health emergencies, but said that the severity of COVID-19 is what is different. This is a much more aggressive infection. The attention to detail has to be a lot more stringent, he said about donning and wearing protective equipment. He said testing numbers locally also are improving. I think it's always to expect the worst and hope for the best. Kucich said no one can really predict how bad it will be. He said OSF Sacred Heart is here to provide the services and deal with whatever surge happens. Families and community members will be taken care of. He too added that if patients don't have health insurance, it's a general practice. At OSF, we take care of our patients. Insurance is not a determining factor. Kucich said stringent hand washing remains an important protection and staying at home is best. That's what's going to help slow this down, he said. Everyone should consider themselves at risk for exposure to COVID-19. That means that everyone should stay home as much as possible and self-monitor for symptoms. Self-monitoring means checking yourself daily for fever, cough, shortness of breath, a sore throat. Health officials do not indicate testing for mildly ill or asymptomatic people. To protect patients, family members, and staff from the spread of infectious conditions, OSF Healthcare Sacred Heart Medical Center has implemented strict visitor guidelines and hospital access. OSF Sacred Heart is restricting visitors to one visitor per patient for only critical ill patients, patients at the end of life, and patients in labor and delivery. Out of an abundance of caution and based on recommendations from state and local health agencies, OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center has rescheduled all classes, support groups, and events through April. The hospital has also eliminated truly elective procedures and will stage other procedures based on urgency. For more information on novel coronavirus, which is called COVID-19, including frequently asked questions, you can visit the COVID-19 Digital Health Hub at www.osfhealthcare.org/COVID-19/. If you suspect you have novel coronavirus and it's not an emergency, do not go to a hospital or doctor's office. Instead, use a digital care option. Connect with OSF's chat box, Claire, a digital assistant, by clicking the Start Coronavirus Screening at the website osfhealthcare.org. You may also call OSF's 24/7 nurse triage line at 833-OSF-KNOW, which translates to 833-673-5669. Also, the OSF COVID Companion is a free text messaging tool that the public can use to receive guidance about COVID-19. To subscribe, users can text OSF to 67634. Other COVID-19 patient resources are Carl at 217-902-6100, or visit carl.org for an online screening tool and patient information about COVID-19. A smart form will guide patients through a series of questions to assess their symptoms and risk and provide guidance on how, where, or if a patient should seek care. At Christie Clinic, you call 366-4070 from 8 to 5 Monday through Friday, or you can visit christieclinic.com or follow Christie Clinic on social media for the most up-to-date information on COVID-19. This headline reads, Never Too Late, Civil War Private to Get Stone by Mary Wyckoff. During a walk through Spring Hill Cemetery last summer, Duncan Outer spotted a name that sounded familiar. Duncan 12 had heard stories from Larry Weatherford, president of two historical groups, about Private George McKibben, a Civil War veteran. As a result of that walk and subsequent action, McKibben will get a headstone. Also, the stone for his father, Thomas McKibben, will be repaired, all thanks to an eagle-eyed youth. Members of the Ward Hill Lamon Civil War Roundtable and Ileana Civil War Historical Society will dedicate George McKibben's stone in a ceremony tentatively set for May. Specific details will be determined later depending on the coronavirus situation. These soldiers like George McKibben, who had brothers, cousins, friends, and family serving in the Civil War, need to be remembered, Weatherford said. Tara Outer, a member of the Civil War Roundtable Board, said, We're very pleased that the VA approved our application for George's stone so quickly. She said the marble headstone will be cut, engraved, and delivered within 4 to 6 weeks and will be installed by the cemetery staff shortly after that. The groups are working with Adams Memorials to repair George's father's stone. We will be placing a small bronze marker in front of it since the 1870 tombstone is almost unreadable, she said. What's unique about George McKibben is that he survived the Civil War, but then died in a shooting in downtown Danville about a month later. His death on October 1, 1864, is perhaps the most documented death in Vermilion County. The person who shot him, Dr. James H. Ferris, later was tracked down to Dr. Theodore Lemon's home and shot several times by an angry mob. Duncan remembered hearing that story from Weatherford. The boy is interested in history and is the youngest member of the Civil War Roundtable. His mother, Tara, helps with the roundtable's research for stories and dedications, and his dad, Mike, is a Civil War living history presenter. Last summer, Duncan was walking through Spring Hill with Rhea Weatherford, also a roundtable member. She was using the tombstones to help Duncan learn local history by searching for well-known names and also math by figuring out people's ages without using a calculator. A boy noticed the headstone of Mary Ann Ross McKibben. Rhea said of the McKibben name, he had remembered it from Larry telling the story about the shooting in 1864, but it hadn't triggered the story until he asked Larry about it that afternoon. Larry said, We visited the gravesite, and I wondered where George was buried. We talked with Cheryl at Spring Hill's office, and the plot records show that indeed he was buried there. George McKibben is buried near his parents, Thomas and Mary Ann, but there's no stone to indicate that. When we saw that George didn't have a stone, it was natural to file to get him one right away, Larry said. And he filed the paperwork with Department of Veterans Affairs National Cemetery Administration. He also noticed the Thomas McKibben stone was broken. It will be repaired later. To summarize the story, George was shot by Dr. Ferris following a Republican rally in 1864, and his brother was wounded. A mob later tracked Ferris down to Dr. Lemon's house, and Ferris was shot. McKibben served in the Union Army, and Ferris was a Virginian who was upset with the results of the Civil War. Weatherford said George's story emphasizes the great divide in our nation at that time. Ferris, who had married the daughter of one of Danville's founders, Amos Williams, is buried a short distance from the McKibben plot at Spring Hill. His original stone was found several years ago when some construction work was being done at the site of the Old City Cemetery near the post office on Hazel Street. Since Ferris has a tombstone at Spring Hill, his weathered old stone stands as a cenotaph, a monument to someone buried elsewhere, in the backyard of the Vermilion County Museum, Weatherford said. Weatherford has an Enfield musket that belonged to one of George's cousins. The family contacted me to see if I would like to purchase it so it could be preserved and displayed for future generations, he said. And of course I did it. It will probably eventually end up at the Vermilion County War Museum, where many of my historical artifacts are displayed. And a little bit more information on that. Veteran's death got a lot of attention in 1864 by Mary Wyckoff. The story of George McKibben's death was widely published at the time. The following shortened version was taken from Lottie Jones's History of Vermilion County, published in 1911. Larry Weatherford, president of two historical groups, said the story leaves a lot of unanswered questions and that he may do more research into it. George McKibben was 18 when he enlisted in the Company B of the 25th Illinois Infantry in 1861. He was mustered out on September 5, 1864, in Springfield. On October 1, there was a big Republican rally in Danville. The election, which was to give President Lincoln a second term, was not far away, and politics ran high in Vermilion County and the rest of the country. The soldiers who were mustered out had not yet set aside their suits of blue and were conspicuous in the streets. Among these were the three sons of Thomas McKibben, Captain Jeff McKibben, Private George McKibben, and Henry McKibben. Instead of going home that night, George stayed behind to look out for his brother Jeff. George didn't seem to be uneasy for his own safety. About 6 p.m., George and Henry McKibben were standing at the public square with Hiram Ross. They were called across the street by Dr. James Ferris and Dr. Theodore Lemon, Ward Hill Lemon's cousin, who were on the opposite side of the street. The men called them over to shake hands. The boys complied without thought of fear and followed the men into the store. The door was closed and the two doctors stepped behind the counter. Shots began to fly in the direction of McKibben boys. The air was full of smoke and confusion when Henry called out that he was hurt. The men who did the shooting made their escape through the back window. Hiram Ross found George dead with a bullet in his temple, and Henry was wounded. Ross took Henry to Dr. Fithian. J.W. Giddings, who lived across the street from Dr. Lemon, reported that he saw Jeff McKibben, who didn't know yet that his brother George was dead, but did know that Henry was wounded, and another man go into the home and come out with Dr. Ferris between them. By now, a mob had gathered, and someone struck Ferris, who fell. The mob closed around him and fired shot after shot into his body. Thomas McKibben, the father, stepped on a box on the street and reminded the mob that he had lost a son, and he pleaded with them to disperse. The firing stopped, and someone grabbed Ferris by the legs and dragged him up the street near the courthouse, where he died later. Ferris was a Virginian and was bitter about the results of the war. In 1882, George McKibben was reburied in Spring Hill after having been taken from the Old City Cemetery. According to the Danville Commercial, when McKibben was taken out, a portion of the bullet that killed him fell out of his skull. Weatherford said, "I really wish we knew what went on when Dr. Ferris called the young men inside to talk. It sounded like it was a friendly gesture. Then something went terribly wrong, ending up with the shooting of both young men." The doctor had served as a surgeon in the 12th Illinois Infantry for 3 months, then mustered out to continue his practice in Danville. His Southern sentiment seemed to increase as time went on, and then apparently exploded on that first day of October, Weatherford said. He also didn't know why Lemon wasn't prosecuted in the shooting and whether the McKibben boys were armed. And now switching to the obituaries for today. The first one, William M. Baker on the headline, but it says William A. Baker in the article. William Baker, 81, of Danville, passed away March 29, 2020 at OSF Sacred Heart Medical Center in Danville. A private family graveside service for Bill will take place on Thursday, April 2nd at Atherton Cemetery in Danville, with Pastor Jay Sorrell officiating. Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center on North Vermilion Street in Danville is in charge of arrangements. Martha Swanee. Martha Ann Swanee, 96, of Covington, Indiana, died at 9:46 a.m. Saturday, March 28th, at the waters of Covington. She was born on January 6, 1924, at Covington, the daughter of Sherman and Ruth Meharry Lucider. Her parents' infant daughter, four brothers and two sisters, and a stepson preceded her in death. Graveside services, 2 p.m. Wednesday, April 1st, in Mount Hope Cemetery, that was yesterday, Covington. Shelby Funeral Home is assisting the family. Dale Fetters. Dale William Fetters, 86, of Hoopston, formerly of Rossville, passed away at 5:16 p.m. Monday, March 30, 2020, at Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Living in Hoopston. Due to the health concerns at this time, a private family graveside service will be held. Memorials may be made to the Rossville Church of Christ in Rossville. Anderson Funeral Home is handling the arrangements. Paul M. Wright. Retired Circuit Court Judge Paul M. Wright, 92, of Lakewood Ranch, Florida, died peacefully on Monday, March 23, 2020, after an extended illness. A Celebration of Life memorial service will be in Montgomery, Alabama, on a date to be determined. Tentative graveside services will be at Sunset Funeral Home in Danville on a date to be determined. It is with profound sadness that the family of Nancy J. Starkey Moore announced her passing on March 30th at the age of 75 in her adopted home of Grays Lake. A private service will be held on Friday, April 3rd at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville on North Vermilion Street, with Pastor Dave Anderson officiating. She will be laid to rest at Spring Hill Cemetery in Danville. Memorial donations may be made in Nancy's name to Danville's First Church of the Nazarene. Howard Varner. Howard Varner, 89, of Danville, passed away March 27th peacefully at his home. Services are private family only on Thursday, April 2nd at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Danville, with Pastor Mark Kaiser officiating. He will be laid to rest at Hicks Cemetery in Perrysville, Indiana. Donations in his memory can be made to the American Cancer Society. And now looking at some community briefs. In Danville, the New Direction Treatment Center's 10th Annual Evening of Hope Community Partnership Dinner, scheduled for April 25th, is postponed. The center is working on all potential options for this event to occur later this year. And that's in Danville. In Covington, the rummage sale from the Covington United Methodist Women's rummage sale scheduled for April 17th and 18th has been postponed until a later date. Roadwork. The Indiana Department of Transportation announces that a project to improve bridge decks on U.S. Route 41 over the Wabash River and on Indiana Road 28 over Redwood Creek begins this week. U.S. 41 bridge work over the Wabash River in Attica is scheduled to last through July 24th. The Route 28 bridge work over the Redwood Creek, 2 miles west of State Road 63 outside of West Lebanon, is scheduled to last through June 3rd. The U.S. 136 bridge over the Wabash River outside of Covington is scheduled to begin on or after June 4th and last through September 2nd. Indiana Route 234 will have intermittent closures beginning on or after Monday, April 6th through April 9th, from just east of Kingman to near the Fountain Montgomery line. Library offers stay-at-home activities by Jennifer Bailey. The days may be running into each other, and the list of possible activities may be running short already for some people bored at home. Even though the Danville Public Library is closed, DPL Executive Director Jennifer Hess offers some ideas to keep people of all ages busy. The Danville Public Library offers many services online for digital download, including books, music, movies, and reference material. Some of these services require a library card number. To sign up for a card online, visit danvillepubliclibrary.org/online-library-card-registration/. Hess says for DPL online services, there are the library's e-collections where you can find entertainment and learning at https://danvillepubliclibrary.org/e-collections. There are downloadable e-books and audiobooks, streaming music, and movies. The Mango Languages Database is a fun tool for learning a new language and something a family can do together. Each database on the page has a video tutorial link to help newcomers use the service. The databases page has more subject-specific items at https://danvillepubliclibrary.org/databases. There are also auto repair manuals from Chilton. U.S. History and Context is a newer subscription which would be a great research tool. For families, there's BookFix, which presents video storybooks. Creative Bug is a new database from Joanne Fabrics, which has crafting projects and tutorials for all levels of expertise. For writers or those who may want to try writing, NaNoWriMo is hosting daily writing prompts throughout their website. In general, I would suggest using the time to try something new. Read the books you've been meaning to. Start a daily yoga routine. Write a few pages. Explore and use our resources to help you start. Sign up for a library card to use virtually now and come in to pick up physical items once we open again, Hess says. Also, we are keeping our social media pages active with other online resources as we find them. So be sure to like our Facebook page or to follow us on Twitter, she added. Well, there aren't a lot of sports to report, but I will give you this article. IHSA, which is the Illinois High School Sports Association, hopes for a spring season. May 1st can still bring a short season, by Marvin Holman. After Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker extended the state stay-at-home order to April 30th on Tuesday, the IHSA is still optimistic about a spring season. IHSA Executive Director Craig Anderson said that if schools are open by May 1st, then there will be time for a possible short season with championships in June. In its discussions thus far, the IHSA Board of Directors has been highly supportive of creating an exemption to the IHSA season limitation bylaw to allow spring sports to play into late June, but competing into or beyond July is not being considered at this time, Anderson said in a press release on Wednesday. We are also realistic in recognizing that any further school postponements or the cessation of physical school attendance for the remainder of the year will almost certainly result in a cancellation of all remaining IHSA sports and activities this school year. While May 1st is the target date, the IHSA is cognizant that state government, educational, and health bodies will need to approve any action. Also, coaches will ultimately need to work in conjunction with their local school administration, as some school districts may choose to be more restrictive in their decision to return teams to practice or games. The IHSA have also continued to state that players in a spring sport cannot play for a travel or club team while school is closed, or they will not be able to return to their high school team if the season resumes. But players that also compete in a fall or winter sport like basketball can play with the club team in that particular sport. Also, high school coaches can provide guidance on the types of workouts and skills that individuals from their team can compete in on a voluntary basis, as lost as coaches aren't requiring individuals to practice the skills or complete the workouts. Some coaches still provide personal lessons only if it is part of his or her livelihood and provided to students other than those attending the high school where he or she coaches. Also, a student cannot repeat a grade if spring sports are unable to be conducted and cannot compete in virtual competitions. And from the Associated Press, Census Day arrives in the U.S. with a focus on coronavirus. Census Day, the date used to determine where a person lives for the once-a-decade count, arrived Wednesday, with a nation almost paralyzed by the spread of the novel coronavirus. But census officials vowed the job would be completed by its year-end deadline. The virus's spread has forced the U.S. Census Bureau to suspend field operations for a month, from mid-March to mid-April, when the hiring process would be ramping up for up to 500,000 temporary census takers. The Bureau also has delayed the start of counts for the homeless and people living in group quarters like college dorms and nursing homes, and has pushed back the deadline for wrapping up the headcount from the end of July to mid-August. The Census Bureau is required by federal statute to send the president the counts that will be used to carve up congressional districts, a process known as apportionment, and draw state legislative districts by December 31st. Some groups are suggesting that the deadline be pushed back, though it's currently mandated by federal law. We are laser-focused on the statute's December 31st deadline for apportionment counts and population counts. We will continue to assess all of our operations to see if there are any changes that need to be made, said Michael Cook, Chief of the Public Information Office at the U.S. Census Bureau, said Tuesday. The headcount started in late January in rural Native villages in Alaska, but the rest of the country wasn't able to start answering the questionnaire until the second week of March, when the Census Bureau's self-response website went live and people received notices in the mail that they could start answering the questions. But that was only a week before many governors and mayors started issuing stay-at-home orders to slow the virus's spread, greatly hindering in-person rallies, meetings, and door-knocking by activists to raise awareness about the 2020 census. Experts say connecting with trusted community leaders in person is the best way to reach people in hard-to-count groups that may be wary of the federal government. There is the issue of attention. Certainly, when folks are anxious about the public health issue and kids are away from school and they're being away from work, it's a concern that the census isn't on top of people's mind as you would want it to be, said Thomas Saenz, president of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. The U.S. Census Bureau is spending $500 million on outreach efforts, including advertising, and it's relying on more than 300,000 nonprofits, businesses, local governments, and civic groups to encourage participation in their communities. Those outreach efforts have been hamstrung by the nationwide shutdown. Groups are switching to digital efforts to get out the word. On Wednesday, the activist group Faith in Action was holding a Twitter chat to encourage people to fill out their census forms, and Census Bureau Deputy Director Ron Jarman was heading to Reddit to spread the word. Comcast NBC Universal and Telemundo on Wednesday unveiled census public service announcements starring TV hosts Joy Reid and Jose Diaz-Balart, and said it was providing $2 million in grants and in contributions kind to community groups in hard-to-count areas. Call for virus volunteers yields army of healthcare workers by the Associated Press. The work is exhausting and dangerous, the situation bleak. But an army of healthcare workers heeded New York's call for help, reinforcing hospitals overwhelmed by the coronavirus pandemic. So far, at least 82,000 people have volunteered for the state's reserve force of medical workers, a group that includes recent retirees returning to work, healthcare professionals who can take a break from their regular jobs, and people between gigs, according to health officials. Few have made it into the field yet as hospitals and state regulators vet enlistees and decide how to deploy them. But Governor Andrew Cuomo said Tuesday that's about to change. By Thursday, hospitals expect to hire about 1,500 volunteers to rescue a medical workforce that needs relief, particularly in New York City. Healthcare workers who have hit the ground already, many brought in by staffing agencies, discovered a hospital system in danger of being overwhelmed. "I have never seen so many human beings in an ER at one time in my entire life," said Liz Schaefer, a nurse from St. Paul, Minnesota, who had her first shift Tuesday at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan. "Shoulder to shoulder, it's a sight I never thought I would see. Patients are dying every day, every single day." Similar recruiting efforts are underway in other states preparing for waves of patients, including California, Washington, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Louisiana, Massachusetts, Oregon, Virginia, New Jersey, North Dakota, and Washington, D.C., and recruitment is happening at the federal level, too, where the Army and the Department of Veterans Affairs have reached out. The death toll from the virus climbed to nearly 2,000 Wednesday across New York State, with most of the fatalities coming in New York City in just the past week. Several of the dead have been healthcare workers, including Caius Kelly, an assistant nurse manager in the emergency room at Mount Sinai West Hospital, who died March 24th after becoming infected with the virus. Many other medical workers have become seriously ill. Protective masks, gowns, and gloves remain rationed at some hospitals due to anticipated shortages. Despite those risks, many have volunteered to join the fight. "Whatever it is that they need, I'm willing to do," said Jerry Copps, a licensed nurse on Long Island who was on tour as a musician in the Blue Man Group before its North American tour was interrupted by the corona shutdown a few weeks ago. "I keep thinking about my old coworkers and friends that are still in nursing, and to me, it's like they have to be there. I should be there too," he said. "If it means being at a testing site, cool. If it means being relief staff for RNs that are overworked right now in the hospitals, cool." Hospital volunteers in New York will be paid, but that is not always the case in other parts of the country that are seeking medical volunteers. In Washington State, for instance, volunteer retirees who staff free clinics are not routinely paid for their work, but those who volunteer at hospitals will be paid. Adding to the core of state recruits are more workers being brought in by staffing agencies. Boy, there's just a lot of news about this, and I'm sorry that the news is full of it, but that's what's in the paper today. I wish you a good day. This is Kathy signing off for Thursday, the 2nd of April.